Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
227,000 new jobs, a cool 250,000. Don't quote me on this, anybody, but I think we can safely say the recovery's here to stay. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Friday, the 9th of March. Good to have you with us. As I said, 227,000 new jobs were added to the economy last month. The numbers for December and January were bumped up as well from previous guesses. And if that sounds like the perfect place to start our weekly wrap, well, that's because it is. Here to do that with us are two of our usual suspects, Felix Salmon from Reuters, John Carney from CNBC. Gentlemen, happy Friday.
Thanks for having us.
Hi, Kai.
All right, Felix, is the recovery here to stay? I mean, you were pretty positive as you were writing about this morning.
I was. I think when we first started getting these great jobs numbers, everyone worried that they were aberrations. And then the more of them that we've got, the more it seems like we are seeing a real trend here. And the economy is really generating new jobs month in and month out. It would be a surprise now if it failed to do that for any length of time.
All right, John, rain on my parade here, dude. What do you got?
I can't rain on your parade. Okay. I actually agree with Felix here. I think that I was one of the people who thought that when we saw a lot of jobs created in January, that was an aberration, that it was a statistical fluke, something that was wrong with the numbers. But we keep seeing jobs being created. The market's been up now 4 weeks in a row. I think this is it's a very good sign.
You mentioned the market, and we'll just do a little sidebar here to point out that this is the 3-year anniversary. It's either today or this weekend or something of the low, right, John, of the post-crash low.
Absolutely. It was March 9th. And my late colleague, Mark Haynes, actually had one of the most prescient market calls on March 10th, 2009. He said, this is it. We're past the low. The market's going to go up from here. And that's what it did.
Well, so what do you think, actually? We can just stay on the markets for a second, Felix, and I know you're not a big fan, but trouble ahead or are we all right?
The stock market?
Yeah.
I think it's very easy to get caught up in the level of the stock market. It's largely meaningless, to be honest.
Right.
It's discounting a huge amount of stuff in the future, which we have no idea what's going to happen. The interesting stuff, I think, the more interesting stuff is happening in the bond markets, which are still pricing in
very weak economy. I knew you were going to go to the bond market.
And, low inflation and possibly even deflation, flight to quality. Like, what we're seeing, insofar as the stock market is healthy right now, and it is not being ratified by the bond market.
Well, let's continue with the bond market then, Felix, and we'll just do it a little bit sideways, and we'll talk about Greece. There was, and it's a little bit technical, so you need to speak English here, there was this event today in Europe. The people who get to decide these things decided that Greece actually did default on its debts, right?
A bunch of self-appointed derivatives experts decided that for the purpose of derivatives, there was a default. Now, we all knew, those of us living in the real world have known that Greece is certain default for months now. But now it is official. If you care about credit default swaps, which no one does,
Wait, hold on. You say credit default swaps, and we all think, oh my God, AIG, and it cost the federal government a bajillion dollars. This is different?
This is very different. We have a very small amount of credit default swaps outstanding, only about 3 billion euros or so, and they've all been margined. They're all accounted for. The auction is going to go off relatively smoothly. There's nothing to see here move along.
The guys who I talk to aren't worried about this at all because these are pay-as-you-go derivatives so that everybody is, as the bonds were going down, there was money changing hands. So it's not like they flipped the switch and all of a sudden everybody has to go scrambling looking for the money. money. It's already largely changed hands.
All right. So if that's all good, then what else is left out there for us to worry about, if anything? I mean, things are getting better in the domestic economy, right, John?
Things are getting much better domestically. I think the greatest threat out there is actually the success of the Greek restructuring.
I was going to say that.
Can create a temptation for other countries to say, I want that same deal. If you're Italy, if you're Spain, you say Greece didn't have to pay all of its debts. Why should I? Just that discussion, if that really gets going, could cause a panic in itself. Because while the system, the financial system, can take a hit on Greece, it can't take a hit on, it could not survive the same level of haircut in Italy, in Spain, in Portugal, in Ireland. That would be a calamity.
Well, Portugal and Quickly Ireland are up next. You know, they have a lot of debt outstanding. And if they look at Greece with any degree of envy whatsoever, then, you know, they're democracies. They can refuse to pay unless they get a haircut. And that would be disastrous.
Yeah, let me recap here. So we're good. Europe is still a mess.
Exactly.
All right. Felix Salmon from Reuters, John Carney from CNBC. Thanks, guys. Have a good weekend.
USA.
Thank you.
on Wall Street today, big start, so-so finish. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The Labor Department rounds the unemployment report to the nearest thousand. So it's tricky to break those 227,000 new jobs down granularly. But we were thinking this morning what it might be like to be among the newly employed in a long recovering economy. And after some digging, we found three people who've contributed to healthy jobs reports the last couple of months. And we reached them, of course, at their new jobs.
I'm Michelle Bennett. I'm in Columbia, Maryland.
Why are you in Columbia, Maryland?
There are jobs here.
How long were you out of work, Michelle?
From July of 2010 until November of 2011.
Tell me about this new job. What are you going to be doing?
I'm a research analyst, and I help with program management. I also do research, and I prepare reports.
So what's it like to have the prospect of money in your pocket after a year and a half of, I'm going to guess, dipping way into savings and being broke?
Savings? What savings? I don't have any of those left. Yeah. I was literally down to my last month of rent and being able to pay my bills before I'd either have to sell my belongings or get a credit card.
And now you can go spend $4 on a cup of coffee if you want to.
I can. So, you know, I was driving down the road the other day and I said, oh my, I could pay someone to wash my car. I mean, it was amazing to just think, wow, if I wanted to buy, you know, a fresh piece of fruit just on the fly, I wouldn't have to stop to think about it.
Michelle, thanks so much and good luck.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Cora Beyer, and I'm in Mesa, Arizona.
What's your last year been like, Cora?
It's been rough. I was out of work for 9 months.
How'd you find your job?
Through a recruiter.
Tell me how it feels.
Oh, it feels great. It's in contracts with a construction company. I just hope they have it in the budget to keep me, that I can become a permanent employee.
So do you think you got a job because you were out there hustling, or did you get a job because the economy's getting better?
I think that there was an opening here. I don't think it was because the economy is improving too much, although I do see signs, not particularly in my industry.
Cora, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Jason Linker, and I live in Baltimore, Maryland. I work with the Department of Health and Mental Hygiene in the Center for Immunization.
For the state of Maryland?
Yes.
This is a little bit of a touchy-feely question, but what does it mean to you now? With a child, and after having been out of work for 22 months, what does it mean to have a job?
When at the very worst parts of this, I felt like I was not a person that my daughter could be proud of. If I didn't get back out there and start providing for my family again, I didn't feel like I would be, you know, a good dad. But, you know, I powered through and it paid off eventually.
When you got the phone call or the email or the text or whatever it was that let you know you had this job, what was the first gut reaction you had?
There was a little bit of quiet dancing in an embarrassing fashion. I felt so great. And then I had scotch.
Jason, thanks a lot for your time. Congratulations, man.
Thank you very much.
Cora Beyer, Jason Linker, and Michelle Bennett came to us through the Public Insight Network. There were big doings in the media world today, big and young doings. 28-year-old Chris Hughes, who helped Mark Zuckerberg start Facebook and so is now ridiculously rich, has bought the New Republic. The New Republic, that 100-year-old intellectual journal of opinion, the very epitome of long-form sit-down and think-about-it journalism, the anti-Facebook, if you will. For those who might be thinking right now, 28-year-old billionaires buying things, hey, you kids, get off my lawn! Consider this. We asked Gregory Warner whether old media is the new playground for the moguls of new media.
Nothing says I've arrived, like buying a newspaper or a prestigious magazine.
I mean, Chris Hughes is not the famous founder of Facebook. That's Mark Zuckerberg. He's better known today than he was yesterday after acquiring the New Republic.
Tom Rosensteel is director of the Pew Project for Excellence in Journalism. And let's face it, excellence in journalism needs money, especially the long-form, opinion-y, magazine-y stuff. That doesn't sell a lot of ads.
And they've always needed the backing of rich benefactors.
Such as Marty Peretz, who bought the New Republic 40 years ago.
And I think it's given Marty Peretz a seat at the table in kind of setting the conversation in Washington.
Cindy Stivers is editor-in-chief of the Columbia Journalism Review, also a place for long-form, in-depth think pieces. So could intellectual journalism become the new status symbol for the Silicon Valley set? She hopes so.
And perhaps he wants to express his views in more than 140 characters. Imagine that.
But they've only given me 60 seconds for this piece. So in Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
Congress did some budgeting this week. Lawmakers trying to figure out how much they can spend next fiscal year. NASA could get as much as $17.7 billion. And with all the space shuttles headed to museums, that's a whole lot of money, as Sabri Benishul reports from Washington.
So right now, the U.S. can't send anyone into space. Nobody. We pay the Russians to do it.
Upwards of $500 million a year.
Jim Dunstan calls himself a space lawyer. He represents private launch providers. There are a couple other options. One is to have private companies take crews up to the space station, sort of like FedEx, but for astronauts. Dunstan likes this idea.
We can't continue to operate the way we're operating. It is too expensive.
Private companies say they could carry people into space for at least half the price that NASA charges. But NASA's also working on its own rocket to go beyond the space station. It's a big rocket called the SLS. Boeing is one of the contractors working on it. Jim Chilton helps head that up.
It's a rocket intended to explore beyond low Earth orbit. Think about it. If we don't do SLS and we only do commercial, we service the space station until the space station is done, then what's the space program?
SLS wouldn't fully run until 2021, but the Obama administration says it could help get a ship to Mars or an asteroid one day. There is one small problem. All these spaceships are expensive.
Nobody who knows this well really thinks that you can have both at the funding levels that are proposed.
Last year, Congress cut the commercial crew budget in half in favor of the big rocket. This year, the Obama administration wants to put some of that money back, and there's a tug of war going on. Congress really likes the big rocket.
It's one word. It's jobs. Over the last decade, NASA, unfortunately, has become a high-tech jobs program.
And while NASA may not be the most efficient, it does have experience. And some aren't sure if these new space companies will come through. Scott Pace heads the Space Policy Institute at George Washington University.
Human spaceflight is incredibly difficult and incredibly dangerous. And so going directly to a reliance on commercial crew delivery systems is something that some people feel is very risky.
But if private companies don't get off the ground soon, they may miss their opportunity to get to space at all. The earliest a commercial crew would launch is 2017. The space station is set to close 3 years later. I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Coming up, L.A.'s newest art star, a really, really, really big rock.
This will be something, you know, people will say, meet me at the rock or, you know, come park at the rock, that kind of thing.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials added 14 points today, a tenth of 1%, closed at 12,922. The Nasdaq tacked on 17.6%. Finished at 2988. The S&P 500 gained 4 points, a third percent, 1370 at the bell. For the week, the Dow slipped a tenth percent. The Nasdaq rose 4 tenths. The S&P 500 inched up 0.1%. Coffee produced some big movers today. Starbucks shares jumped nearly 3%. The company plans to launch its own single-cup brewing machine for home use. That move gave caffeine jitters to investors in Green Mountain Coffee, the market leader in those types of machines. Green Mountain shares withdrew more than 15% today. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.03%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to freakonomicsradio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, a look at the nation's balance sheet. The Treasury Department is scheduled to release its monthly statement for February. On March 12, 1933, Americans tuned in to hear the first of President Franklin D. Roosevelt's fireside chats during the Great Depression. And be prepared to be tired. Consider leaving work an hour early today to offset the hour you'll be swindled out of this weekend as we spring forward. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. On Sunday, Japan's going to mark the one-year anniversary of the Fukushima earthquake and tsunami. 16,000 people were killed, by best estimates. Billions of dollars in damage. Disruptions literally to the global economy. Just think about Honda and Toyota sales the past year. But as catastrophes like that one play out over time, the economic costs become less clear and sometimes turn into benefits. Marketplace's Scott Tong was in Japan last year just after the earthquake. We sent him back a couple of weeks ago.
It's been a long 12 months for Japan Inc. But even before the earth shook, the foundations were weak. Take longtime electronics giant Sharp. It's endured several disasters this past year, starting with a quake and tsunami. Those prompted power shortages, so Sharp cranked out fewer TVs and LCD panels. Then floods in Thailand knocked out component makers. Another whammy came when Japan's currency soared, making exports pricey and uncompetitive, just in time for Sharp's 100th birthday.
This is production facility to manufacture mechanical pencil in 1921.
At the company museum, our tour guide touts historic company inventions, like the ever-ready Sharp pencil. Sharp has also pioneered TVs, solar panels, a talking calculator.
Can I press?
But now it's counting company losses. $4 billion last year. Sharp stock has fallen 20%. And for shoppers in Tokyo, Sharp these days seems dull. Here's 24-year-old Yusuke Akimoto.
I don't buy Sharp for like almost 5 years. So I don't know like what's going on over there right now.
Sharp faces two big problems. First, TV prices have cratered, killing profits. And then there's something called Galapagos syndrome. Remember Charles Darwin's finches? Each bird developed a beak unique to its island? Well, Japanese products have evolved, but just for their island. Hop on the subway, and you spot a distinct species of Japanese cell phone. It gets TV signals. It works as a debit card. But it doesn't text very well.
It's very high-end, but you cannot sell outside of Japan.
Columnist Waichi Sekiguchi says companies like Sharp have developed market tunnel vision.
They pay more attention to the domestic market rather than foreign markets. That caused the problem, you know, in Japan.
Problem? Because Japan is aging, so its market is shrinking. Meanwhile, invasive species are everywhere. The iPhone is the latest predator. So Sharp is trying to evolve, diversify more into products like solar panels and air cleaners at home and abroad. But big companies tend to move slowly. Still, that doesn't mean all of Japan Inc. is necessarily past its prime. Newer firms can be more nimble, like Japanese e-commerce champion Rakuten. Like Amazon, Rakuten.com lets you buy everything, including eggs. You can book a golf tee time, buy plane tickets, blog. And in the year since the earthquake, Rakuten has leveraged the strong yen and acquired several companies abroad. It's now the world's number three online retailer. Like Silicon Valley firms, Rakuten offers lunch to workers, no charge. Which brings us to that old saying about the non-existent free lunch. The catch? At Rakuten, employees have to speak English. CEO Hiroshi Mikitani has decreed what he calls Englishnization.
Today, we are going together close to 500 merchants in Tokyo.
He even does his conference calls in English. The point? Rakuten, like Japan, must go global.
The walls are coming down. You cannot just sell your content to US or just to Europe or just to Japan. You need to be able to sell it globally.
Englishnization has its critics. Honda's CEO has declared the idea stupid. But Mikitani is not the backing down type. In fact, right after the tsunami, he quit a big business lobbying group when it supported the hugely unpopular nuclear power industry.
The fact that Japan is moving to new Japan is very, very important for me, and I felt that I cannot be part of this organization anymore.
Mikitani is a rare Japanese risk taker. He started out as an investment banker. But in the 90s, a previous deadly earthquake in his hometown of Kobe prompted soul searching, and he started something new. This latest disaster, he figures, is spawning a new generation of entrepreneurs. In Tokyo, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
As he and I discussed the Freakonomics of presidential elections this week, Stephen Dubner said that when you look at the evidence, there's really only so much presidents can do that actually changes the economy. Stuart Roychester from Palo Alto, California, sees it differently.
After 9/11, President Bush elected to go to war in two countries. The trillions of dollars spent certainly did affect our economy. That same president followed the Home Ownership Society policies of Clinton, making it easier and easier for citizens to buy homes. The Great Recession ensued. The bubble collapsed.
Commentator Robert Reich addressed the cost of college on Wednesday, and he said, among other things, that maybe students from higher-income families ought to pay more in tuition to subsidize students on the lower end. Sarah Ford wrote from Worcester, Mass. with this.
College should just be less expensive for everyone so that more people can attend. Just because someone was born into a wealthy family, they shouldn't have to pay more than someone who is not. That would only create resentment, I would think.
Finally, our college roundtable in Atlanta on Monday. Four graduating seniors at Emory University talking about life after college in this economy. I asked, mostly seriously, actually, whether anybody takes a year off after graduating anymore to go backpacking through Europe or something. Yeah, it's not really an option, they told me, but Lars Guy in Ketchum, Idaho, says it ought to be.
Now would be the perfect time to run away from this mess, if only for a while. The chance may never again present itself. Jumping right into the fire after finishing an 18 or more year education will probably never allow them the feeling of pure freedom from responsibility or obligation. This is especially depressing with the economy such that it is.
As always, let us know what you think. Email works best. letters@marketplace.org. I don't want to make what's going on in the rest of the economy feel slighted. I mean, the Greek debt crisis, Super Tuesday, and, yeah, I don't know, the iPad 3 are certainly worthy topics, I guess. Here in Los Angeles, though, we've been obsessing over something else. A rock. A really big rock. 20 feet tall, 340 tons. Boulder, I guess, is a better nomenclature. It's been making its way through Los Angeles to the County Museum of Art, very slowly, for a new installation by the artist Michael Heiser. That's right. It's a $10 million rock show. From KPCC in Pasadena, Sandin Totten reports.
Angelenos haven't been this riveted by a slow-moving vehicle since OJ's white Bronco crawled down the 405 freeway. The boulder is traveling 100 miles over 11 days. The rock rolls all night and parties every day. That's what happened when it parked in Long Beach on Wednesday.
I'll just remember it as a special day.
That's 7-year-old Othello Hernandez.
I've seen a rock that big. I think it's pretty amazing.
Also amazing is the $5 million trailer carrying the rock. It's 2 stories tall, the length of a football field, and 3 lanes wide. Terry Emmert is in the driver's seat.
Quite a view up here, isn't it?
He's the vice president of Emmert International, the company tasked with moving this boulder. And if you think your car is a gas guzzler, consider this.
I'd say we're probably getting about 15 gallons per mile. We're doing about 8 to 10 miles a night.
That means moving the rock can burn through 150 gallons a night. Then there's the crew readying LA's streets for the trailer.
It's tens of thousands of dollars a night for these crews to be out here removing signals and utility lines and cables. And then as soon as we pass by, they have to put them back up.
The total price tag for this work of art is estimated around $10 million, only $70,000 for the rock itself. The LA County Museum of Art is footing the bill. LACMA's Miranda Carroll says even though they get some taxpayer money, none of that went to the boulder.
Not a dime. Everything is paid for by private donors.
The finished piece will be titled Levitated Mass. The rock will sit atop a trench. People can walk under it. Carroll says bringing artist Michael Heiser's vision to life is a big investment. But it could become an L.A. icon, like the Hollywood sign.
To have an actual identifying symbol, I think, is very significant. This will be something, you know, people will say, meet me at the rock, or, you know, come park at the rock, that kind of thing.
$10 million for this, I don't know.
That's Stephen Pater. He came out from Hermosa Beach to see the rock.
A scholarship or two would have been a lot better way to spend the money. But, you know, it's a free country, so they got the money, they can spend it the way they want.
And you know what they say, you can't put a price on art. I'm Sandon Totten for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, turns out the world's not going to end. You remember Harold Camping, the 90-something-year-old preacher who predicted the end of the world last year and a couple of times before that, spending millions to get the word out? Yeah, he says he was wrong. Camping said yesterday, and this is a quote, "We humbly acknowledge we were wrong about the timing." And Camping said he's not interested in considering any future dates for the rapture. So there you go. You can wake up tomorrow morning. And that's Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Today, the Dow added 14 points, a tenth of 1%. The NASDAQ tacked on 17.6%. The S&P 500 up 4 points, about a third of 1%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's acting producer is Megan Larson. The executive producer of the broadcast is Deborah Clark. J.J. Yore is the vice president and general manager. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, what bill collectors will do to turn a profit.
I started calling every one of them back and going back and forth until I finally get the originating account number, and it comes down to I was paying multiple times for the same account to multiple different collectors.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you back here on Monday. Have a good weekend. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.